today, even though it was announced we're going to do lament psalms, and we're actually going to do a penitential psalm. And I have to go back and check my outline and see whether I'm the one who's off base or if Elmer Witt's off base. Usually I find it's me, but it doesn't make that much difference. We're going to be doing a lament psalm on Friday, and we'll be talking about more about that. So I wanted to communicate to Annette, who is taking this tape, and say all set, Annette, or something like that, to get this started. Just as we begin here, many of the books that I suggested they purchased, and I noticed they already been sold out in the bookstore. They don't have any more. But there's several books that we can talk about from time to time if you're really interested in the Psalms, because you can get them in any good religious bookstore. You know, they're very easy to get, and I'll be sharing those. Sometimes the most helpful thing is just to get other, use the word translations of the Psalms, or other insights into the Psalms. A neat set of books are by Leslie Brandt, and you can take a look at these, and maybe some of you know Leslie Brandt. He calls them Prayers for 20th Century Based on the Psalms, and what he has done is he's rewritten the Psalms. And he does so in a way of taking liberties, etc., to paraphrase the Psalms and make them, quote, contemporary, you know. And I think he does a good job. This was his first volume, Good Lord, Where Are You? That sold, so you know when it sells, you write another one. There's plenty of Psalms you can operate out of. God is here, let's celebrate. And it's a continuation of his very free paraphrasing of the Psalms. He also has done some paraphrasing of the epistles, et cetera, et cetera. I know Leslie Brandt, he's an ALC pastor, and I knew him in when he was out in Glendale. I believe he was in Glendale, out there in the San Fernando Valley, out in Los Angeles area. And I knew Leslie. He was meeting with one of our pastoral groups, and but he. Anyway, that's one of his gifts. So if you want to do that. Another book I have up here, I don't know, it's Psalms for All Seasons. These are meditations or little homilies or meditations on the Psalms by David Hubbard. David Hubbard is the president, I guess, of Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena, and et cetera. And I had lunch with David Hubbard once because he was at one time a roommate of a good friend of mine. Long story, and a very interesting, competent Old Testament theologian, besides being the president of a very well-known and a very prestigious seminary, Fuller Theological Seminary. Maybe some of you know of it. Anyway, tomorrow I'll introduce a few more, tomorrow's Christmas. The day after Christmas, I'll introduce a few more books to you if you're interested. Well, when we doing the Psalms, we talked that one of the background structures to help us get into the Psalms is the experiential things of life. And we said life comes out of periods of orientation, and we said periods of disorientation. And then we talked about new orientation, and in these. And these express the seasons of life. The seasons of disorientation are those times in life when everything has shifted, when life is no longer well-orientated, whether God's in his heavens, you're not too sure, you know that all is not right with the world, at least all is not right with your world. And it can be, be something that is just a little bit out of kilter, or it can be extremely out of kilter when everything is coming apart in life. And this pushes us into the large percentage of the Psalms. The large percentage of the Psalms address disorientation. not orientation. And we're going to be going into that a little more depth on Friday, because about, I think it's 73 of the Psalms, I always get my numbers mixed up, which is quite a few, are called lament psalms. Lament psalms are those psalms which the psalmist is crying out to God because he finds himself in a situation which he did not create, and it's been, quote, come upon him. It just happened. And we all have experienced those kinds of things, and we say, Lord, why me? For example. And we will find in those laments, there are individual laments, and there's also communal laments, but they take up the greatest body of the Psalms. And in those laments, we will also find, I think, an interesting, if not a fresh way, of both addressing God or taking seriously the God who reveals himself to us and the God who calls us into a covenant relationship. So much so that Brother Martin again will say that it's only in the depths where God will meet you. You know, that phrase of his. Now that, don't analyze only, you know, and say, wait a minute. But you get the hyperbole there, you know, of that. That there, God, when God meets us in the depths, we confront God in a new way and a fresh way, which we never can on the heights. And the Psalms are expressing more of those experiences than the experiences on the heights. Okay? Now, in these Psalms of disorientation, we have the lament psalms. We also have psalms which are called penitential psalms, and there's seven of those in the book of Psalms. And some of these, I believe, are familiar to you. You use them in your liturgical worship. There's Psalm 130, for example, out of the depths have I cried unto thee, O Lord, Lord, hear my cry, etc. Psalm 32, which talks about the iniquity and transgression and so forth. And what that does to us, we can even talk about it in psychological terms, how it eats away at us, etc. But these psalms will maybe define a little bit the thing of sin or transgression, or talk about it. But what we're going to do today is get to Psalm 51, which is actually a confession of sin. And that makes it very personal. And it's also lets us see that when we come into, when all of life becomes disorientated, when that which is, everything was going well, and now suddenly everything is turned around, so that we can lose everything that we have ever had. You know, that's climactic in life. It can be, of course, as we said, from the lament psalm, circumstantial. That has happened to people. Why me, O Lord? But it also can be because of us. And that's where you get to the penitential psalms, and that's where you get to this particular psalm, and Psalm 51. Where this whole disorientation comes out because of, quote, our sinfulness, you know, because of us. And that's what we're going to get into today. Psalm 51. And also I'm going to, again, be using some of Luther's commentary on this psalm. I am doing this because yesterday we did some on Psalm 2, and I think it's good that we can just use some of him on today. Likewise, with some insights. Psalm 51. Now, the background of the psalm, I think most of us are familiar with. Or at least, you know, you have to be, if you want to be very, a critical scholar. And by the way, we have scholars sitting around, I find, in the room here. If you want to be extremely scholarly and be very, you know, objective with the psalms, we really have difficulty in knowing, to proving authorship or proving all historical situations. And because the Psalms, as we know, now that we understand the Psalms better and their development, really developed over a period of years and centuries, really, and they were used as in community as part of the worship experience and the experience of the people themselves. Now this Psalm, again, is attributed to David, and I'm going to operate on that historical setting. I'm just going to operate on that because the psalm at least comes alive against that setting. And because editors have said, this is the psalm of David when Nathan had the prophet came to him after he had gone to Bathsheba. It's a little bit of a phrase on top. But some of the original manuscripts, that's not there. And so you have to be just honest. I'm just saying that to say, hey, just be, use the word cautious as you make a lot of, there's a lot of talk called the Psalms of David, David, David. But that becomes a school of psalmody. And so it doesn't mean David wrote them all. And we'll see today in this particular psalm, we have a problem. If you want to get into historical criticism type of thing, I'll just mention it to you. It's no big deal. I want to get into the theology of the psalm. I want to get into what it's saying to us and why it's part of the prayer book of the community of believers. Somebody here can, just so we all know where we're coming from. When it says the prophet Nathan came into David after he had gone to Bathsheba, what does this refer to? Somebody just give us the historical background. I'm sure we know it, or some of us know it. And where's that reference? Can somebody give us the reference and just in a few words summarize the historical background as at least suggested for this psalm? Anybody? Nobody knows it. Come on now. All right, you got a cross-reference there, right? You're looking cross-references there?
No, I just looked it up.
Oh, you just looked it up. Oh, well.
The ALCW Bible study for July this month was on Bathsheba.
It was?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, it was. It says in my Bible, a psalm of David when Nathan the prophet came to him after his sin with Bathsheba.
All right. Now, what is that? What happened? That's right. That's what they're doing. But what is that? That's the description there. Give me this. And you said it was 2 Samuel 12. That's right. 2 Samuel 12 and also 13, if you want to include Nathan. Very quickly, what was the story there? What's the background?
David had taken Bathsheba as his lover. And in addition to this, he had, to cover up his sin, he had sent Bathsheba's husband Uriah into the forefront of the battle so that he would be killed. And following this, Nathan the prophet told a little parable to David about the rich man who had a great flock of sheep, and a visitor came to be with him, and instead of taking one of his own sheep to slaughter for the meal, he took the sheep of a man who had only one sheep, and slaughtered that. And Nathan the prophet, or when David heard this, he was very angry and said that man should be put to death. Mm-hmm. And Nathan pointed at David and said, "You are the man."
Yeah, that famous sentence, yep. A bold step, by the way, for a prophet. You have to know that in the, again, in the Mideast, not so much with the kings of Israel, but with the monarchy that came through the Mideast, the king always had life and death in his hands all the time. And no one really approached the king except by invitation. Just read about the monarchs come out of Persia or Babylonia. Go back in that period. You only came in by invitation. And then usually, if you read some of the monarchs that come out of Persia and you go back in those older empires, you always read how they used to crawl in and kiss the feet first. Yes, this you're dealing with quote God here, okay? Please get that imagery. Now, it never really carried over quite that much with the kings of Israel. They never became quite that godlike, you know, in that sense. But the point is, they always had life and death in their hands. And if the king would said, "Let that man be killed," that man was killed, and that was it. I mean, there was no thought, you know. And this kind of you have to get that. So for Nathan, you say, well, he was the prophet of God and so forth. The prophet takes his life in his hands to confront the king, in a sense. So let's take Nathan here. He takes his role there. And we read to that, and you hear the story, you know, to realize what Nathan did, because he sucked him right into a trap, you know. And thou art the man. Wow. That was... At that point, anything could have happened. But what happened is we know David at that point, everything breaks. I mean, everything, you know, now comes alive for David. And David, at least at this point, doesn't commit the sin, you know, of not recognizing it, but saying, uh-oh, you know, everything is out now. Everything becomes like that clear. Up to now, he was playing games. And no more games. No more games. Okay, we get a Psalm 51. I'd like to have us read this Psalm. And let's just begin with it. I'd like to have someone read the first five verses. And if you use a translation other than RSV, which is, by the way, perfectly permissible, please tell us the translation you operate out of. That always helps me a little bit, where you're coming from. Someone, Psalm 51, verses 1 to 5.
Have mercy on me, O God, according to thy steadfast love. According to thy abundant mercy, blot out my transgression. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me. Against thee, thee only, have I sinned and done that which is evil in thy sight, so that thou art justified in thy sentence and blameless in thy judgment. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me.
Let's continue. Someone, would you pick up verses 6 through 9?
Sincerity and truth are what you require. Fill my mind with your wisdom. Remove my sin, and I will be clean. Wash me, and I will be whiter than snow. Let me hear the sounds of joy and gladness. And though you have crushed me and broken me, I will be happy once again. Close your eyes to my sins and wipe out all my evil. That's today's English version.
Okay. Good News Bible. Now verses 10 to 12, which is part of our liturgy and some words that we often sing as part of our worship. 10 to 12.
Create in me a clean heart, O God, and put a new and right spirit within me. Cast me not away from thy presence, and take not thy Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of thy salvation, and uphold me with a willing spirit.
Someone 13 through 17, which is now, we begin to see a change in the psalm, something that's been happening or anticipated happening by the psalmist, 13 to 17.
Then I will teach transgressors your ways, and sinners will turn back to you. Save me from blood guilt, O God, the God who saves me, and my tongue will sing of your righteousness. O Lord, open my lips, and my mouth will declare your praise. You do not delight in sacrifice, or I would bring it. You do not take pleasure in burnt offerings. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit. A broken and contrite heart, O God, you will not despise. The NIV.
NIV, okay, thank you. 18 and 19, now, interesting, now look at 18 and 19. And give me, become all historical, biblical critics now, and give me the problem now that these two verses raise. Not theological problems, I'm talking about historical problems. Someone read 18 to 19, and somebody else say, hey, you know, what problem does this raise, just historically?
Rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem.
Yeah. And what's the problem?
That was much later.
Yeah, much later. Rebuild the walls of Jerusalem is a post-exilic term, after the exile. You rebuild the walls. The walls weren't built yet in David's day. You know what I'm saying? It's not true. So you say, wait a minute, David couldn't have said that. You know, how can you rebuild that which isn't built? The rebuilding of the walls. So you say, hey, this is a later time. Many critics, by the way, many scholars say, hey, this is an addition. These two verses were added at a later time to really both justify and to explain why they still had the worship they did. Because you notice the verses there, thou has no delight in sacrifice, then it comes along in these verses, do good to Zion in thy good pleasure, rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, and then it says, then thou will delight in right sacrifices. Now it explains, you know, in a way, why we can still go through our morning worship service. And by the way, that's okay, because as we will see, there's a transformation here of heart, which means then you can establish the worship, and then it has meaning. So it fits even theologically. But I'm just saying, and I don't want to get into the historical criticism, it doesn't mean that much to me at this juncture. I just point that out to you. So I always do that in the class, because you'll always find somebody who will. And it's usually somebody at a party who, you know, who wants to nab you, you know? Did you know? You know. And you look at them and you say, yes. You know, I mean, why not? You know. I like to raise a lot of, you just raise the problem. And when it's raised up again, you say, yeah, I know the problem. Doesn't mean anybody has the final answer either, by the way. But that's not what we're going in here for today. Now that we said that, let's back up into the psalm itself, and let's see what meaning we get out of this, and what discussion can prove helpful for us today in our sequential thing of the psalms. And by the way, in these last, for you, some of you may have been here for 2 weeks. This is the only penitential psalm that we'll be dealing with in 2 weeks' time. Again, Brother Martin, here he is. Okay. It says here, this excellent exposition of 51st Psalm by the Reverend Father Dr. Martin Luther has been published for the glory of Christ and the good of the church. I mean, somebody must have taken notes on this when he gave his lectures. Now he begins. Last year, we expounded the second psalm. Yesterday? Okay. Last year, we expounded the second psalm on Christ the King and his spiritual and heavenly kingdom, and how he is received in the world, vexed and wounded by kings and people, yet how he conquers and triumphs. Okay? We had that yesterday. Okay? Now, I have begun the exposition of the psalm Miserere, which teaches about repentance. I cannot promise that I shall lecture satisfactorily, for I admit that I have not fully grasped the spirit who speaks there. Since it gives us an opportunity and a basis for thought and study, so that I can become a student with you and await the Spirit. Whatever he gives, we shall receive with thanks. Interesting little introduction, isn't it? He says, I don't think I'm going to do satisfactorily this job. And I think anyone who deals with both Scripture and Psalms at this point, I can go along with that. I can say that today. I certainly don't know if this presentation will be satisfactory, because I don't know if I fully have grabbed it myself. But together, let us go into it. And I think that's the spirit that we have to go into it. Let's just begin and look at that. The first phrases here. I'm going to begin with a few comments of Brother Martin, and then I'm going to go into some of, quote, is with my exposition, and then your exposition is invited. And Brother Martin makes a few little insights here, which I think are relevant for days of 20th century Christians. Today, I don't think we talk too much about sin, or if we do, we usually approach it with some forms of psychological terminology of how we explain actions or reactions. And also, we have difficult handling guilt, because we have done poor jobs with guilt by the mere fact that we really project a lot of guilt on people. You know, parents can do it to kids, and we all know that. And so much of guilt is projected guilt, or we bring guilt upon ourselves. By that is, it's not real guilt, it's projected guilt, and I think we know that there is a difference. Although the what happens on the inside of us really doesn't differentiate between the projected or the real. And therefore, sometimes it's good in counseling to realize, hey, you know, I have a lot of people that will come to me with a lot of guilt, and as they talk, I realize it's not actual or real, it's projected. Somebody has put a load on them, you know. And we do this to ourselves. And therefore, we often live with guilt when really we don't know how to live, you know, outside of that pattern. And I'm aware of that. And by the way, so is the Scripture. So is the Scripture. I myself can live with it. I can operate sometimes with guilt. And Carrie, my good wife, Carrie often says to me, you know, it's too bad you don't believe in the forgiveness of sins, or something like that. And it's difficult, really, to live in this kind of forgiveness, because we live with that. But that's not what the psalmist is addressing here. I just want to make sure that when we talk about this, we're going to talk about real sin. That means something that is so real that if we don't take it seriously, it's to our particular detriment. And so we're going to have to talk about that today. And I think it's, in a sense, uncomfortable, and it's certainly not popular. But today, we're going to do it because the psalm drives us to that. And Brother Martin will come through and he'll say, The failure to understand sin properly from this error, he's talking about the errors that he sees in the church around him. For this error, their failure, he's talking basically the papal church, to understand sin properly, there comes, of course, the other error, their failure to understand the nature of grace properly either. Now, Brother Martin will say, if you don't understand one, you're not going to understand the other. And so let's see if he's right as he expounds this. Because I think he's on to something here. And if we take sin in a superficial way, we take grace in a superficial way. And Brother Martin does not permit that in this psalm, I'll tell you that. When he says they, that's usually the papal. If you read the whole text, you'll see he means that. Taught the same way about repentance. People were to collect all the transgressions of the past year, sorrow over them, and expiate them by satisfaction. I ask you, does not a judge hang a thief if he confesses his theft and is sorry for it? Yet these people think God is satisfied if they pretend to be sorry by dressing differently, walking differently, and eating differently. He says, they don't know what sin is. They don't know the reality of it, what it does, and how God reacts. He's talking about the whole nature being contaminated by sin, and David here. David is the example. In this deed, there appear other sins than merely the one with Bathsheba. To his adultery, he added a very wicked plan. He pronounced the man who had stolen his poor neighbor's ewe lamb worthy of death. You were mentioning this before. Meanwhile, he did not see his own sin when he murdered Uriah, who was undoubtedly a good man and faithful to his king, and took away his wife. He wanted to look like a holy man who loved right and justice. This doubled the sin. Not only did he cover up the vicious murder of Uriah, but other Israelites also perished, and the name of the Lord was blasphemed. Thus, he went beyond the fifth and sixth commandment to sin against the first, second, and third as well. This is just a loser. Nor would he have left inviolate the fourth about duty toward his parents if it had stood in the way of the adultery he desired. Now notice, Luther is getting into underneath this right now. The drive here of this man, he wouldn't even stop at that. So Luther already writes that one out too. And you say, wait a minute, you get into this and you say, Luther's on to something here. He's got the driving, the human predicament. The collapse, actually it is with blasphemy that God specially charges him. Nathan, 2 Samuel, because Nathan says, you have caused the Ammonites to blaspheme. Don't you know one of the judgments that comes upon the people of God is that the people out there, the unbeliever, the Gentile, blasphemes the name of God because of the way we act or the way we do things. Yeah. Taking the name of God in vain. Emptying it, by what we do. And that gets awfully close to home, A few more comments. And then I want to... He's talking about our natural powers, the human predicament, and Martin Luther does not mince words on this. We say that the natural powers are corrupt in the extreme. When he was created, Adam had a right will and understanding. He could hear and see perfectly. He could took care of earth things perfectly with praise and faith in God. Through the fall, his will, understanding, and all natural powers were so corrupted that man was no longer the whole, but diverted by sin, lost his correct judgment before God, and thought everything perversely against the will and the law of God. Then, this is from his, he's repeating now some of the stuff comes out of his Genesis commentary. Adam, he no longer had an adequate knowledge or love of God, but fled from him and hated him, supposing that he was not God, that is, merciful and good, but a judge and a tyrant. This is the way Luther expounds it. This comes out of his Genesis thinking, I think in Genesis commentary. The mystery of sin, he says, is that Adam turns his back on a good and gracious God and would choose this other God who's a tyrant. He says, that's the deception of Satan. He says, tell me, what's the rationale in that? You can't. It's the mystery of sin. And so on. Interesting explanation of sin. Now, just to get a little bit of more of Luther as he talks about sin. And so on, and it'll help us with this psalm. Not just here, but I'm going to use this, the two ways of knowing sin, experimental and speculative. You have to get a little bit of Luther's thought here. He knows it. Two ways of knowing sin, experimental, he'll talk about the event over against something that is purely facts. We'll talk about something that is concrete over something over here that's abstract. Or talking about something that's quotes about the depths. Over here, it's surface. Or talking about something that's me. Talking about something over here that's it. Let's take a look at this a minute. See how Luther handles this here in his comment. He says, this knowledge of sin, moreover, and he's talking now that David here has come to a knowledge of sin. Okay? But now he's going to be talking about this knowledge of sin in an experimental, that vein, not speculative or this vein. Then this knowledge of sin, moreover, is not some sort of speculation, an idea, which the mind thinks up for itself. It's a true feeling, a true experience, a very serious struggle of the heart. As he testifies when he says in verse 3, I know, that is, I feel or experience my transgressions. It does not mean, as the Pope taught, to call to mind what one has done and what one has failed to do. But it means to feel and to experience the intolerable burden of the wrath of God. The knowledge of sin is itself the feeling of sin. And the sinful man is the one who is oppressed by his conscience and tossed to and fro, not knowing where to turn. Therefore, we're not dealing here with the philosophical knowledge of man, which defines man as a rational animal, and so forth. Such things are for science to discuss, not for theology. So a lawyer speaks of a man as an owner and master of property, and the physician speaks of a man as healthy or sick. But a theologian discusses man as a sinner. In theology, this is the essence of man. The theologian is concerned that man become aware of this nature of his, corrupted by sins. When this happens, despair follows, casting him into hell. In the face of the righteous God, what shall a man do who knows that his whole nature has been crushed by sin and there's nothing left in him, nothing left on which he can rely? You see, there's nothing he can grab hold of, but that his righteousness has been reduced to exactly nothing. Notice that Luther never says that man or humanity is reduced to nothing, but his righteousness is reduced to nothing. That which he wants to hold on to suddenly is not there. Okay? And he says, this twofold knowledge of God, this twofold theological knowledge, which David teaches in this psalm, he says, David is teaching us this, so that the content of the psalm is the theological knowledge of man and also the theological knowledge of God. He says, therefore, it's experimental on this side. It's not speculative. We're not going to be talking about sin. We're not going to talk in some abstractions about grace or surface stuff, not about it. David comes over here and pulls us into something concrete, will pull us down into the depths, because David's talking about me, you know, down in here. And that, he says, is a big difference when you're going to begin to discuss this. And so on. And then we begin with that first verse. Now, I think this insight now is something that's very, quote, Lutheran, and something I like, has mean much to me, and I like to think it might be very helpful to you. And this is the good doctor. You know, we have to say, what made this man the way he was? Now, Luther, by the way, was not perfect. A lot of things he said he should never have said. A lot of things he did, you know, we don't, won't even explain away. But you have to still say that what did he have? What insights did he have that became so incisive that it really changed and altered a whole area of the church in history? You know? We have to ask that question. I had a professor I took a course in 16th century history, doing some graduate work down at San Diego State College, which now is, well, they changed all of California, it's University State College or something like that. And the professor I had there, I remember he had a big thick mustache, and
His wife was Lutheran and attended my congregation attendance. That was accidental. I learned that out after the fact, you know. Had nothing to do, you know, just accidental. But he was. And he just couldn't stand Martin Luther. And here we are in the 16th century, and he always let him, he always up front where he was coming from. And he couldn't buy Martin Luther. And the reason was, he was, if you know anything about 16th century history, he was a man that really was a Charles V advocate, you know. And good old Charles, you know, he was trying to begin to unify Europe there. And he first of all had a problem with the stupid Pope in Rome. He had to take him on for 10 years, you know. And then he had that crazy German monk up there in Germany, you know what I mean? And all of these things just always he had to deal. He never could do his plan. And by the way, Charles V, if you ever go back to history, he was an honorable man. He was an honorable man. He was trying to run the empire. And he had better ideas than most. And then he couldn't deal with that German monk because he needed, I told you yesterday, he needed those German soldiers up there. And he realized that you have to be careful, you know, up in German territory. He always had to walk on eggs a little bit. And you have to be a little empathetic with Charles V. You have to be a little empathetic. You have to read history correctly. And so my good professor there, he did not like Martin Luther. Well, after about the third week in lecturing on Martin Luther, get this now, Doctor, we know that you don't like Martin Luther. Why are we still hearing him in this third week of lectures? You can't go through the 16th century and walk around that man. I said to him, just in utter pain. By the way, his lectures were honest and good. He knew Luther. I wanted to say that, you know, and so on. I liked this man. I really did. He was a good professor. See, it doesn't matter what slant you're coming from, as long as you're honest. You know, that's what I feel. And he was honest in his lectures, very honest. But I'll never forget that. Just can't walk around this man. And it's true. You cannot. It's the way it is. I say this not because we're Lutherans, it's good to hear type of deal. But I think it took me a long time even to sense this with him. Luther, have mercy on me, O God, according to thy loving, steadfast love, according to thy abundant mercy, blot out my transgressions. And so forth. And right away he begins. Now you have to understand Luther now. He begins from a Christological sense. He always, David mentions God and makes no reference to Christ. We would say, of course. Dumb remark. Here at the very beginning, you should be reminded of something so that you do not think that David is talking about God like a Mohammedan or like another Gentile. Okay. So in other words, no more Snickers. David is talking with God of his fathers and the God who promised. Now just listen to this. The people of Israel did not have a God who was viewed absolutely. These are terms that he will use. These are terms that he'll be using. He'll be using the term absolute. Absolute. That word absolute God. Okay? Look at that a minute. The people did not have a God who was viewed absolutely, to use the expression, the way the inexperienced monks rise into heaven with their speculations and think about God as he is in himself. By the way, we have a tendency to do this at times. From this absolute God, everyone should flee who does not want to perish, because human nature and the absolute God, for the sake of teaching, we use this familiar term, are the bitterest of enemies. So when you begin talking God now, you talk about God in the absolute sense, the encounter, he says, is absolutely devastating. Human weakness cannot help be crushed by such majesty, as Scripture reminds us over and over. Let no one, therefore, interpret David as speaking with the absolute God. And that's out there. He is speaking with God as he is dressed and clothed in his word and promises. Since in the name God, we cannot exclude Christ. And just notice, now, don't leave him yet. whom God promised to Adam and the other patriarchs. He takes that very, very literally, very much so. We must take hold of this God, not naked, but clothed and revealed in his word. Otherwise, certain despair will crush us. This distinction must always be made between the prophets who speak with God and the Gentiles. The Gentiles speak with God outside his word and promises, according to the thoughts of their own hearts. Ah, but the prophets speak with God as he is clothed and revealed in his promises and word. Get that imagery. Just get that imagery there. Thus, this God, clothed in such a kind appearance, and so to speak, in such a pleasant mask, that is to say, dressed in his promises, this God we can grasp and look at with joy and trust. The absolute God, on the other hand, is like an iron wall against which we cannot bump without destroying ourselves. Therefore, Satan is busy day and night making us run to the naked God so that we forget his promises and blessings shown in Christ and think about God and the judgment of God. And when this happens, we perish utterly and fall into despair. Get that? I mean, the old doctor, you know, he's got something here. He's got something here. David is not speaking with the absolute God. He's speaking with the God of his fathers, with the God whose promises he knows and whose mercy and grace he has felt. Okay? In the Psalms, too, it often speaks about the God of Jacob, you know, with that little term, you know, the God of Jacob is our refuge, et cetera, et cetera. And at least in my younger years, you know, I always said, well, we always say the God of Jacob, you know. Some people say, who's Jacob? You know, I've had that. In fact, I say, well, what does that mean? It's interesting, the psalmist does not talk about the God of the sun or the moon. Do you ever notice that? It's always the God of Jacob or the God of Joseph, you know. Why? Because it's always the God of history, God who has revealed himself to people, and when he has done so, he's always revealed himself in his promises. He's always the God of promise, right? The God of Isaac, right? You can add to that.
Abraham,
but he's never, he's not just God, you know, God out there. He's always the God, quote, of Jacob, which brings him right down into history, brings him down to the point where he has met us, taking our human, whole human race. He has met us always in his promises. That's where he's come to us. That's why when David is praying, he's not praying to the God, the absolute God. The naked God. He's clothed. I like that. In his promises. You know? And that's why he says, that's the way Jesus Christ is. He's always clothed with that. It's just a way of saying it. I don't know if you want, anybody want to react to that? I don't know if that's helpful. Ready?
I'd like to say something.
Pardon me?
When I was reading this, I've read this song before, but when you were reading it today,
yeah.
I was thinking, what a gutsy fella to have pulled such a heinous crime and then appear to God, something that I know you'll forgive me and please live up to your promises.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't understand how he could be so confident.
Mm-hmm.
Because I guess that when we sin, we have to rely on the promises of God instead.
Well, come on to it, you know. By the way, David's in terror here. And I'll share it later on in the psalm. I'll share it later in the psalm that he's in terror. And I'll demonstrate that in the create section. So let us not say, well, I seem to be here, now I'm going to go over here, you know. You know, like people say, well, you Christians, you know, you sin because you're going to go to confession and you know God's going to forgive you. And by the way, you play around with God's grace like that, and I don't want to tell you the judgment against you. You don't play with God's grace. You know, and I don't, you know, you're not saying that. But there is terror here, and I'll try to demonstrate that later. And see if we see that in the psalm, and we'll see why that is. But you're right. You know, David here is at the point. And by the way, David is a prince of a fellow. I mean, he's when you read it, read him in you know, there's a lot of space given to David. He has 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel. You know, just in the Bible. I mean, this guy gets a lot of footage. Only the other one gets more, I think, is Moses. So I mean, and it's not accidental that today, you know, when you have the contemporary Israel, you have Israel, you know, and they have the sign that what the Star of what?
Star of David.
Star of David, because it's David who becomes the symbol of the kingdom for the Jew, very much so. And you go back and you study David and you see why. He was a prince, he was a ruler, his men would do anything, he would go into battle any place. He was a brilliant commander. He really was. And he also was, you read this, and that's the one who does this. The prince. And Luther makes a comment. He said, you would not believe a prince like this would fall so low if it wasn't the Bible who told him. You know, you wouldn't believe it. You'd say, no, I don't believe it. But the Bible tells us, therefore, we got to believe it. This guy really fell. I mean, and it's bad. I mean, it's bad. And we'll see how bad it is. And David, at this point, we'll just use David's term, he senses this. And he knows at this point now, suddenly, he is stripped of any righteousness of his own, and he has to suddenly now cling totally to the promise. That's the only thing that's going to save him, is that promise out there. It's the only thing that's going to save him. Because you realize, now in the other Psalms, you'll see in the other Psalms, that many of the Psalms, that the Psalms that we come before God, and here is experience a disaster in his life, and will always defend himself because, look at Lord, it's not my sin that did this. I'm innocent. It's not me, O Lord. My hands are clean. You know? Was it you? Yeah, wait a minute. The psalmist. He'll address God at this point. Or he'll say, it's my enemy, you know, out there. And we don't want to get to that today. But here, this psalm is interesting because every commentator says, hey, and the psalm here, David's not saying, hey, well, you know, Lord, everybody slips a little bit, you know. Pardon me, you know, that kind of thing. Everybody does it, Lord. There's none of that. There's none of that. In this psalm, suddenly, he is making absolutely no excuse and says, if you're righteous in your judgments. If you're going to come in your wrath, you only prove that you're right. Yeah. There's David at this point. But he is now going to come back. And you see, to force God back on his promises, though, is going to take faith. If you're going to force God back on his promises, and this is a serious encounter. This is no game play. This takes faith, and this takes trust that God forgives. Okay, let's get into this. Anybody, please comment as you go. And I'm not going to do much more Luther, by the way, but I think... Huh? Oh, pardon me.
He says, against thee only have I sinned.
Mm-hmm.
Well, David's sin was against many more people than just... Doesn't that say to us that whenever we sin against our fellow man, we are also sinning against the great God, and that this is, psalm includes all of that?
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's just jump to that. We're jumping down a little bit here, and that's good. I mean, let's get this out of here. You know, I have had... next door to Palisades Lutheran Church is the synagogue. So we have Old and New Testament, they say, around the block. And the rabbi there, good friend Jack, who, by the way, is no mean biblical expositor. He's the third rabbi that's been in that synagogue since I've been here. At the Lutheran Church, and he is, for my money, the best Bible student they've had, biblical scholars. He's good. I have some of his tapes and the prophets, and he's good. But it's interesting how he'll treat this here, this little phrase, and I want to talk to him about it because I disagree with him. And you disagree with the rabbi, you know. He says, "What do you know, Meyer?" You know, and so forth. This is my book. Well, all right. He will say this, that there's different junctions in the development of consciousness of sin, and at this time there's no social consciousness. It's only a personal thing. I'll take issue with that with him. You know, that there is no... He's not conscious of what he did to people, just me and God. And I take a little issue with that. And I have other reasons for it, because I think you're already picking up something. But that's what he says here. Against thee, the only have I sinned. He said, wait a minute. Wait a minute. You've sinned against a woman here. You know, doesn't she amount to something? I mean, there's Bathsheba. You know? I mean, there it is. And from the sense of the power of the king, she had no rights. Isn't that a sin? What about her husband?
He didn't know what was going on either.
You know it, and what about the nation? You know that you did. You blasphemed its king, etc. You go right down the line, and you say, hey. What do you mean? Against thee only have I sinned. I think we have to get underneath this here. We have to get underneath this here. And I, not only does Brother Martin get underneath this here, by the way, if you get into his commentary, I'm going to jump, and I just want to read a little bit from a contemporary scholar. Maybe some of you know Walter Brueggemann. I know he lectured up here a few years ago. And he's a very competent Old Testament scholar, nationally known, and Eden Theological Seminary. And he has done some neat stuff in the Psalms. And let me just read. I have a few notes I just grabbed from him. And just to say, hey, I don't care if you want to go back into the 16th century doctor, you know, you want to go to a 20th century doctor of theology, let's just hear what they say. And they both say that they say practically the same thing. Real sin is a violation of relationship with God. Yes, sin is against the neighbor, and most sin is played out in the social arena. I can you read my writing? But here, sin is a theological problem, not moral, ethical, or psychological. There's other dimensions to it, but here's theological. This does not mean there is not hurt. I mean, a lot of damage and a lot of rather hurt. But the righting of the wrong concerns the godness of God and none other. And then Brueggemann says, we forget our skewed lives must finally deal with God. You know, all of this is true. So that when you say, against thee and thee only have I sinned, and we went over before that Luther went down the list of commandments, you know, and right away we think of sin over against laws, even the great law, you know, or the Ten Commandments. Well, you sinned, you committed adultery, you know, and that's true, which means you're dealing over against people. But sin is not so much the breaking of God's law as the breaking of God's heart. And again, the psalmist, and this is true in the Lament Psalm, the psalmist always thrusts us, or he himself thrusts us, not over against the Torah. Even Psalm 119, which is the psalm, one of the great psalms of the Torah, you know, the ultimate relationship is not with the Torah. As you read that psalm, it's always with Yahweh. And so the psalm, and so David is so far in the depths, that he says, I mean, not that this is all heard out there, all the stuff that he's done, but what has happened now isn't that he broke laws or just hurt there. What he has finally done is broke the heart of God, the one who's good and the one who's faithful. Notice the relationship there. And this is the way I interpret this, and I'm glad that Brother Martin agrees with me. That little note I had in here, I had my Bible for I don't know how many years and years and years before I discovered that Martin was on the right track, and also I came across Brueggemann. I say in this because I think this insight is something to sense for us 20th century people. And remember Jesus himself, when you say our skewed lives must finally deal with God, you know, even Jesus does that in his great parable of the judgment. He says, inasmuch as you've done it, what? And he said, he's my brother, you've done it to whom?
Me.
And if you don't do these of my brethren, you've done it. And the final analysis you have to address, the Holy One. And in fact, because God is behind it all, he's in it all. He's not just, you know, he's there. And I believe that David here is both at that depth and therefore sees this reality, and that's why he's saying that, not to dismiss the other. And the more I get into this psalm, I know I'm on the right track on this one. At least I feel it. So that you're justified in thy sentence and blameless in thy judgment. You're not to blame for your judgment now, Lord. You know, it's going to fall, and you can't be blamed for that. He's not going to hold God. Well, God, you shouldn't judge quite that harshly. He says, no, you can't be blamed. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity and sin, and my mother conceived me. That has nothing to do with sex and sin. That just is saying that, hey, this is my nature. And not as an excuse. Well, I mean, I can't help myself, you know. That's not what he is saying. He just reveals the human predicament. I mean, that kind of confession. And I'm sensing that. And Luther already said our basic nature. And then it says there very definitely that, Lord, you don't look for an outward covering of goodness, which is a sham. You want the truth. Truth is that honesty in the inward part. Therefore, teach me wisdom in my secret heart. See, wisdom here doesn't mean that just You know, don't teach me more facts. Don't give me more abstractions. Don't give me more theology. That's, you know what I'm saying? That's not what he's saying. Don't give me that. Wisdom at this point is spiritual discernment. Wisdom in Hebrew thought is be able to have spiritual discernment. And he says, at this point, teach me some spiritual discernment, you know. I mean, don't give me, I know the facts. I know, you know, all the catechetical knowledge. But now give me that spiritual discernment, which is this, which is the idea of, a Hebrew idea of wisdom, so that a responsible life is possible, you see. And then these words like purge and all of these terms are cultic terms. So that many feel that now the confession is not, doesn't become private, it now has become public because David's going to go through the public ritual of cleansing. Now this may be, I mean, that's a conclusion that is of the commentators, but they may be. When he says, purge me with hyssop so that I be clean, wash me and I shall be whiter than snow. This is a purification, these are all cultic terms, purification terms, that becomes part of the temple worship. So if the sin becomes public, somehow it leaked out and become public, that the Amorites, the Gentiles, those people out there are blaspheming God because of the act, that's what Nathan said, then now the purification becomes a public act. I can't prove that, but at least it's something to think about. Fill me with joy and gladness. Let the bones which thou hast broken rejoice. Hide thy face from my sins and blot out all my iniquities. Hide thy face from my sins. When, again, Hebrew thinking, you know, the blessing, the Aaronic blessing, the Lord bless you and keep you, and, you know, make his face shine upon you. You know, God, give me the right body language. You know, it's beautiful term, very concrete terms. And when God's face does not shine upon me, we'll see this in the Lament Psalms, Psalm 8, for example, that God no longer is, has hid his face from me, is I'm experiencing the absence of God. Now, that's a Lament Psalm, where I look around and I can't even find God. God is not there, the absence of God, which is living in, quote, the hell of, you know, of the moment. David is saying here is, I want you now, though, don't hide your face from me, you know, but hide your face from my sin, you know, turn your back on it, you know, that concrete imagery. But he's playing on that term, hide, and thy face, you know, don't hide your face from me, but turn it on my sin. Just do that. That dastardly thing, the prince falling so low, and hide your face from me. Let me just read what from Brother Martin here, this little phrase. To call on God and say, have mercy, is not a great deal of work. But to add the particle on me, this is really what the gospel inculcates so earnestly. And yet, we experience how hard it is for us to do it. It's one thing to say, you know, have mercy on me, O Lord. We sing the Kyrie, you know, on Sunday morning. Oh, Lord, have mercy. And we always look over there and sing some else. Mercy, you know. You know, we always sing it because we all know by heart. He says, no, not difficult to say, have mercy. It's difficult to say, Lord, have mercy on me. Because already that's a posture of relationship, you know, that's saying something about me as well as about God. But you know, Luther does this word for me. He loves those little personal phrases. And you know, in the Catechism again, when he's talking about in the sacrament, where he's saying about how can the sacrament do such great things and so forth, the Holy Communion. And then he always comes back and he says, it's the words for you. Remember that? That requires you to believe. You know, how do I know if I'm rightly prepared? You know, that one there. He says, just to believe the words for you. Do you believe that? Prepare. You know. That's what makes the gospel the gospel. Otherwise, the gospel stays to be a fact in history. It becomes abstract. You know, it's all surface stuff. It's it out there. But the word for you. The word for you. And so here it is. Have mercy on me. Now, when you personalize it, you know, that's, and it's not easy to do. It's not easy to do. This on me hinders almost all of our prayers, when it ought to be the only reason and the highest occasion for praying. A little bit of insight there. maybe that's enough. Let's just go to a few more. Oh, it's 10 o'clock. Oh, she's going to cut the tape. Just have 1 minute. Let me just ramble quickly. I'm sorry about the time running out. But I told you before that let me see how deep this is and why that's so serious. And I just discovered this recently, and I think this is a valid insight. I think this is a valid insight. You know, when you take the create in me section and cast me not away and restore, there's the word wind or spirit is used 3 times there. Did you notice that? Put a right spirit within me. The word spirit is the Hebrew word ruach, which means wind, ruach. Put the ruach within me. And this is the ruach that brooded over the waters in the creation. Wherever the ruach goes, there's always something that's created new. The ruach of God, the spirit of God. And he says again, take not thy holy ruach from me. You know, when he formed man, you know, he formed Adam, he formed the word man, you say, he formed the humanity is a better way of talking about it in Genesis 2, out of the dust of the ground. And then what did he do? He breathed into this humanity, this hunk of dirt, you know. Whoah, you know. That's not just, he had the animals. They all were walking around too. I mean, you could say they were breathing. That's not what is meant here. The ruach of God is really that which makes us in the image of God. The ruach, you see. And so forth. And uphold me now with a willing ruach. Okay, now why that ruach? If you go back into 1 Samuel, where you have Samuel anoints, you know, that word anoint, which means Messiah, same word. He messiahizes, you know, David to be the future king. Remember that. If you go back in that particular section, it says that at that point of the becoming the Messiah, a Messiah, that act, that anointing, that David received the ruach that gave him the authority to reign and to rule. The ruach of God is what gave him the authority. And David's sin now really is going to cause him to lose the ruach of God, which means he no longer has the authority to rule and will lose his kingship and will lose the kingdom. It's serious stuff. Now you say, well, you know, he realizes how devastating this is. You're losing the ruach of God. And so, and if you read Isaiah 11, one of the great prophecies that talks about the branch of Jesse, that little phrase, read that out there again, and the spirit, the ruach, is the one who is given to the one who's going to rule. And therefore, the ruach is always held in trust, the ruach of God.